And we are back. Thank you for sticking with us. And once again, my favorite time of the show, where I just don't have to listen to myself talk. Joined by a special guest today. We have not had him on before, but I've been looking forward to this for 2 weeks. I think he's got some really applicable experience that will help us, I think, walk through a lot of what's going on and understand it on another level. And as always, I like it because he's actually a guy taking live fire. He's running a macro fund. So I'm happy to introduce Steve Mirren of Amber Wave Partners. Steve, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a real pleasure to be here.
You bet. Well, let's run through. So PhD in economics from Harvard. So like I told him, he wasn't at the bottom of his high school class. That's good news. He said they're letting anybody in Harvard these days. And I said, well, I'm not anybody, apparently.
Almost anybody.
You spent a year working at the Treasury during all the COVID stuff, all that craziness. But give us kind of your bio. So you got the PhD from Harvard. Kind of give us so we know who we're dealing with here, your professional arc. What got you to this point?
Sure. So, I mean, I guess when I, finished college, I went to grad school thinking, at the age of 20, 21, no idea what I wanted to do. And so the best thing to do is to continue being a student. So I went to grad school and did a PhD. Towards the end of my PhD, decided I didn't really want to be a professor. I thought that most of the problems that professors, that, academics work on, seemed to me to be too far removed from the real problems the world goes through. And particularly, I was finishing my PhD in the height of the global financial crisis. And, sort of hearing some of the recommendations that professors were making, that a lot of these really famous professors were making, that seemed so far removed from the way the real world works, really sort of drove me nuts. And I thought, this stuff is it's not so great. So I went into investing, which of course I love because I get to deal with the big picture issues of the day every day. Worked in investing for, I guess, 10 years or so. And then 2020 and COVID happened. And the world was falling apart. The economy was in the biggest shock in, since the Great Depression. I had the opportunity to go help out and pitch in a hand at Treasury and said, this is really once in a lifetime opportunity to help out in the country's moment of need and to be involved in this stuff. And I took it. And so I spent a year at Treasury during the pandemic when, of course, it was a very, very busy time for everyone involved. And then with the change in management at the Treasury Department in the beginning of 2021, left to go off and start my own firm. And so here we are managing macro portfolios and, trying to make heads or tails of a situation which, as you can tell, is pretty volatile.
it's interesting timing because and you may completely disagree with me. And this is a free to disagree zone, just so you know. One of the reasons I want to have guys like you on, just so you know, if you hear me say something you disagree with, fire back. Right. Because it just iron sharpens iron. I do this as much to, inform our listeners as I do to learn myself. But macro was kind of a dead horse there for a long time. Now, all of a sudden, right now it's in the front of everybody's mind. And I've seen things. You'd be better to know this. What I'm hearing and what I'm seeing is that there has been a pretty good flight to macro funds as of late.
Yeah, I don't disagree that macro was a bit of a dead horse for a while. And, we were living in a world in which policymakers were interested in crushing volatility anywhere and everywhere it showed up, right? And if policymakers, are waging war on macro volatility and you're a macro investor, you're not going to have that many fat pitches to swing at. Now, of course, policy is pushing macro volatility higher everywhere you look, right? So we've gone from a world in which you had, one, maybe two fat pitches a year, in which you have seemingly one to two a month, which, of course, means a lot more opportunity. So, my own view is that the asset allocation world that we lived in for the last 15 years or so pre-COVID, sorry, I guess 12 years since the GFC, is going to be flipped on its head. Macro was an unexciting asset class. Think about it. In 2020, right, we had the biggest economic shock since the Great Depression, and because of what we did at Treasury and what our colleagues did at the Fed, the recession lasted 2 months, right? And by the end...
and the market
and by the end of the year, stocks were at all-time highs, right? So, like, that is what policymakers did in order to control economic volatility. And that meant that macro was a dead horse, as you say. And, you know, and strategies which reduced to levered beta, right, whether that's in public markets or in private markets, right, you know, strategies like real estate, you know, PE, VC, all did phenomenally well. Public market strategies like, you know, levered relative value strategies did very well also. And all those strategies, I think, do significantly worse when there's meaningful macro volatility, particularly on interest rates. As a result, I think we're sort of set for a reversal of that over the next decade. You know, I think that it's, you know, volatility, I don't think, is going away. I've been saying that for, you know, a long time now, that volatility, I think, is here to stay for a while. And it's not just monetary policy and fiscal policy, right? We talk a lot about the structural drivers of inflation that have nothing to do with monetary policy, right? Things like geopolitics, land wars, fights over commodity resources, reshoring supply chains, industrial policy, right? There's now a view, in a way that there wasn't a view 2 years ago, that just importing cheap stuff from China because it's, you know, because it may be economically efficient isn't really good for the country, because it makes you vulnerable to, you know, someone in China waking up on the wrong side of the bed and suddenly your supplier, you know, is shut down, or your customer is sanctioned for some reason, you know, because they evaded sanctions or something, right? So I think exactly what you said. We're going to go into the next decade with macro being a persistent outperformer, and lots of those other strategies that really were reliant on calm markets and cheap balance sheet, critically cheap balance sheet for the sake of leverage. You know, I think that those are going to struggle.
It's fascinating. I remember when they were rolling out all that you guys must have been just cranking around the clock when you were there. You said this, and I don't think people appreciate the mobilization that had to occur, right? The bringing people together. Was it just all hands on deck, turning constantly, dealing with that at the Treasury during all this chaos?
Oh, absolutely. And especially, look, as a macro guy, you know, my job before Treasury, I was a portfolio manager at a macro fund, right? A macro portfolio manager at a hedge fund. And like, as a macro guy, my day starts very early in the morning, and it also ends relatively early in the afternoon, right? You wake up, Europe is in full session, you're figuring out what happened in Asia, right? By the time the U.S. data come out, you know, like, your day's three quarters over. And so by the time it's 3 o'clock, you know, I'm usually brain dead because, you know, because the bulk of my thinking, the bulk of my brain usage occurs earlier in the day. Right? I got to Treasury, and immediately I'm working till like 11 o'clock. You know, like, calls are being put on the calendar at like 11 o'clock at night, and my brain was not ready for that.
Yeah, it was. That was a Herculean effort. Okay, so flipping over to the banks, because this is the other thing I really wanted to talk to you about, because I know that your experience lends to this. And I'm virtually positive that I have oversimplified this. So the issues at Silicon Valley Bank seem to me pretty non-systemic, in the sense that, and you can agree or disagree, just look to me like risk management was just completely asleep at the wheel. So let's start there. Would you agree with that?
Absolutely. I think that this was a just childish, you know, like a summer intern. A summer intern reading the job description would have done a better job managing that risk.
Yeah, what I've compared it to is, I think it's even dumber than this example, but it reminds me of Melvin, right, sitting on that GameStop short position, right? Just the risk reward of it was so horrible, but that was even odder because, that was even more understandable than this one. I mean, I the way I equated it was kind of like they sat back and watched a little fire start in the corner of the room and didn't put it out because they didn't want to have water damage to the carpet. You know what I mean? Like, and then the whole bloody house burned down. You know what I mean? Like, it just to watch that, I don't even know how you do that, especially when the Fed's saying, hey, guys, inflation's coming up and we're going to hike. You know, my first thought is running a book would be, what's our duration exposure here? You know,
yeah.
You know, the setup of the banks, what are the other reverberations? Is this all just a big duration issue, or is it pointing to something else?
So it's duration is part of it, because there certainly are banks that haven't hedged their duration like SVB. The duration problems are, I don't want to say solved by the new Fed facility, because you can now borrow at par against any treasuries or agencies you have. What that does is it basically just allows banks to survive on liquidity, and it turns them into zombies, right? If they have tremendously unprofitable lending backdrops because their assets are so low yielding, but they have to borrow from the Fed at 1 year OIS plus 10, they become very unprofitable, even though they can survive on that liquidity, right? But there's other problems out there that banks that can't borrow at this new Fed facility. We hear a lot about commercial real estate, right? You know, it looks like this is mostly office space, right? You know, that's a big problem. And you can't borrow with this new facility if that's your collateral. That's the problem for a guy, you know, for a bank like First Republic. Although actually, First Republic might be residential too. But, you know, if your problems are CRE, which is overwhelmingly in the, you know, problematic in the small bank sector, right, you may just have bad assets. And so what's going on is that, you know, yes, SVB was run by idiots, but, you know, as soon as something like SVB happens, you get the cockroach effect, right? The market sees one cockroach, it's afraid there's going to be 1,000. And so it just winds up turning down every wall, you know, lifting every floorboard, opening up every wall, looking for cockroaches where it can, and the market's testing to see where else there's, you know, who else might be insolvent. And so it is indicative of something broader, which is that banks in general have mismanaged, you know, smaller banks in general have mismanaged their risk in large part because they were able to. Bigger banks weren't able to because they had bigger handcuffs on them.
Yeah. Well, and one of the things that I think about too, and this is more on the philosophical side of it, but from my perspective, when you're sterilizing risk for 15 years, because we started in 08, right? I mean, that's kind of when the sterilization process started. But when you're sterilizing risk for 15 years, I don't think you should be surprised when you end up with feckless people that don't know what they're doing sitting in those risk chairs, right? Like, I mean, isn't that kind of a natural knock-on effect?
Absolutely. And I also think that you can't eliminate risk. You can't eliminate volatility. And every single time you see policymakers try to believe that volatility can be eliminated in, you know, sort of one part of the market, all they wind up doing is pushing it to another part of the market. So the big banks are somewhat, you know, more handcuffed in their risk-taking ability because they're more heavily regulated. But that just pushes the risk-taking behavior elsewhere. And when you have a decade of, you know, interest rate policy that's very, very low, and at times it was appropriately low, and at other times it was inappropriately far too low, right? Mm-hmm. Humans are greedy and short-sighted, and if you incentivize them to take massive amounts of risk, they will find a way to do so. And if you regulate that it can't be done on the left hand, then they'll do it on the right hand. And if you regulate that then it can't be done on the right hand, then they'll do it on the foot. You know, they'll find another way to do it. You can't regulate all aspects of the economy, all aspects of investing, unless you're willing to, you know, sort of basically become, you know, like China or something, yeah. Which is its own set of problems, right? But, you know, you can't eliminate risk-taking. You can't eliminate volatility. And I think that we'd all be better off if policymakers were just upfront with the fact that volatility happens. Bank failures happen. Interest rate shocks happen. Inflation happens. The market should not be complacent. And appropriate risk premiums should be built in all over the place.
Yeah, and that hasn't been the case for certainly a very long time. Okay, so the specialization or the focus that you've had on fiscal and monetary policy and your education and your background. I really want to go back and forth with you here and have the recession, no recession discussion. But before we get into that, what do we do from here? Because I from my opinion, going into that last Fed hike, and I would love, and I want to hear your opinion on this. Because we have my partner, Marcos Bueno, you know him,
yeah.
Right? He and I were having a
– He's great. He's a big fan of Marcos. Yeah,
he's become a dear friend of mine, yeah. And he has helped us dramatically on the performance and risk management side at our firm. So can't say enough of him. He's like a brother. But he and I were having a conversation this morning, and I know the history of Fed decisions, right? I you may know this better than I do, but I want to say it's like once in the last 25 years the Fed made a decision that wasn't priced in prior. Right? Which to me, that is extraordinarily suspicious, right? It leads me to believe that their number one goal in rate decisions is not upsetting the market, right? Because I look at this situation, and the discussion me and Marcos were having is this situation to me, especially now with the bank issue coming on, I really felt like there were two ways to go. Hit the market with a higher rate hike than expected and launch QE to stabilize the bond market, or cut. The thing that made the least amount of sense to me was the 25 basis point hike. I just felt like that was a pass. I literally felt like the only reason they did that is because that's what was priced in. I'd love to hear your thoughts. And if I'm wrong, square me away.
Yeah, I agree completely with what you said. I would say a couple things, right? So one is what you're saying, that the Fed does not like to disappoint the market. There's a couple reasons for that. One is I think they're terrified of volatility. They're terrified of disruption. And like I said before, I think volatility and disruption are a fact of life. And trying to hide from it as a policymaker just pushes it off, pushes it into other asset classes, and potentially makes it bigger. And so I wish that the Fed were not so afraid to challenge the market at times. And two, you know, I think that the Fed really has a quite poor record of forecasting, right? Particularly in the last couple of years. And so they've lost a lot of self-confidence in their ability to forecast. And as a result, there's deference to the market, right? There's a view that the market is correct, that the market synthesizes the wisdom of you know, trillions of dollars out there, and that the wisdom of the crowd is better than the wisdom of the, you know, of sort of the forecaster sitting in their room at the Eccles building or something, right? I think in general that's true, but nevertheless, we all know that markets are excessively volatile. Markets overshoot in both directions, sometimes on the same day. In the last week, that's very true, right?
Yeah.
So I think that there's a combination of those two things make them not hesitant to challenge the market. There's a couple other factors too. One is sort of what's called the McCallum criterion, which is basically the idea that only unexpected monetary shocks have an effect on the economy, because if they're expected, they're fully priced in, right? And so, so this is another part of the reason why the Fed likes those expectations to be priced in before they get there, to avoid the volatility. And so what they try and do is they try and guide the market towards expecting what they want to do ahead of the meeting, right? And the last thing I'd say is that, look, I think forward guidance is one of the worst parts about monetary policy today. Maybe it was arguably useful when you were fighting deflation and out of tools, but we're not fighting deflation out of tools right now. And the Fed just paints itself into corners with its guidance, right? The fact that they try and avoid disrupting the markets means they have to guide the markets ahead of time. Once you guide the markets ahead of time, it becomes costly to deviate from that guidance, right? And so they just wind up doing 180s over and over again, making fools of themselves. And I think it's deeply problematic.
Well, the other thing about it, this is more on the philosophical side, but if you're going to throw efficient market theory at me and you're constantly trying to suppress volatility, the market's not going to give you an accurate reading, right? Because that suppression of volatility, like for instance, one of the things I realized, you know, I come at it from a very Buffett-esque type background, value guy, you know, the old joke, value guys aren't made, they're born, right? It's the way that I see the world. And elevated valuations have been very frustrating for me and for a very long time. But one of the things I thought about was, if you're living through an era where central banks are constantly stepping on volatility, I guess you can sort of justify higher than normal valuations, right? Because the market doesn't have the same level of risk that it does. Well, like you said, you don't get rid of that risk. It's just going to present itself in different ways. But I actually feel like we're taking one step forward and two steps back. We're going to trust the read of the market, but then we're going to try to completely exterminate volatility, which means that the market is going to be less, right? It's going to have less foresight. It's going to have isn't there an inherent problem in there of saying, hey, we're going to trust the read of the market after we just stepped on volatility for the better part of the last two decades?
I couldn't agree more. And the market is pricing back in a Fed put, and you know I can't blame them. I mean, the market may not be correct about that because of inflation, but I can't blame the market for pricing it to begin with, because at the end of the day, we have 6% inflation and a 3.5% unemployment rate. If there, and Silicon Valley Bank is not a systemic bank itself in the way Lehman was a systemic bank, because there's not interbank connections to it. There's not 10 other banks that will fail because SVB defaults in its obligations to those banks, right? The way it was, the interbank obligations are nil. Whereas with Lehman, with CS, with Deutsche, right, the interbank obligations are large. So we have 3.5% unemployment, 6% inflation. If there, we have a bank resolution process in place, right, that we spent lots of time, writing regulations for that, how did that work after the global financial crisis. If there ever were a time in history to try the process as it is, it was now, when inflation is 6%. And you have 500 basis points to cut on the funds rate before you have to resort to QE, right? If there ever were a time in the history of the country to try letting a bank fail, this would be it. And they chose not to do that because they let it fail, but they chose not to let the depositors take a haircut, which, by the way, these depositors, very well off, right? You know, sort of venture capital owned startups, right? Big companies like Roku, at least one billionaire among them. If there ever were a time to try the system that's in place and let it and see if it works, it's this, and they chose not to. So they pretty much told you that they're not going to allow that volatility into the system again, or they're going to try their hardest to get it out. And then at the Fed, at the FOMC this Wednesday, 2 days ago, they told you that the risk to interest rates is asymmetric, right? They told you they're not going to hike anymore because of inflation. Right, that they're pretty much done hiking, but they stand by ready to support the system if the system needs support. So they told you it's asymmetric. So we've had this experience of the Fed put for a really, really long time. I don't think it's surprising that the market would go back to expecting that to be there. Whether the Fed put is there with inflation being so high, will come down to how much tolerance they have for pain. How much tolerance the Fed has for pain if it comes head to head, if the market wants cuts and the Fed doesn't give it to them.
Okay, so walk me through this, because one of the things that has been very hard for me to understand when you're looking at the makeup of the FOMC, right? It's all economists, academics. I don't understand the seeming preoccupation with equity markets. Why aren't they far more focused on bond? I just like it. It was one of those things. I was one of those. my other colleague, a guy by the name of Chase Taylor, who is Pinecone Macro on Twitter. I don't know if you. So he's our head analyst. He starts here full time April 1st for us. He and I have had this discussion many times, and. He coined the term financial justice warrior, which I thought was hilarious, right? I was one of those guys that was, I am a recovering financial justice warrior.
That's good. I like it.
I spent years being ticked off and just raging against the Fed before finally sitting back and going, you know what? Ride the wave, man. Like ride the wave. You may not like it. You may think it's leading to broad, but your job is not to be a Fed critic. Your job is to make money, right? And manage risk. Their preoccupation with the equity market makes no sense to me, right? They believe in the wealth effect, but they're trying to keep the market buoyed while we're dealing with 6% inflation. What is the thought process? Do you have any insight into that? Where I'm sitting there going, why don't you knock the starch out of the equity market, stabilize the bond market? If you got to step in there and do QE or do a Bank of England copy where you're still going to keep rates elevated and launch QE at the same time, or cut, do one of those things. But that decision they made, and I could be off, that decision they made to me, though, on Wednesday, I felt like that was all about the equity market. Am I right in saying that they're over-focused on the equity market? And if so, why?
So normally I would completely agree with you that they're overly focused on the equity market. And the reason they're usually focused on the equity market is because that's what most people pay attention to, right? The Fed is a highly political organization, and they are very keenly protective of their political legitimacy. I think they do a very poor job protecting that political legitimacy, but I think that they view the stock market as generally speaking one of those means of protecting it. It's also one of the primary means of transmission of monetary policy to ordinary households, right? That is very salient for ordinary households. In this case, I disagree that the Fed is focused on the stock market. In this case, I think that they are correctly focused on the financial conditions of the banking industry and of the of credit markets. And so, last week there wasn't a single IG issuance deal, right? Investment grade bond deal, right? That's the type of financial condition sudden stop that doesn't show up in financial conditioned indices because it's a quantity, it's not a price. Right, financial condition indices measure spreads, but if nothing trades, then spreads don't really move so much. If there's no new issue, and that's a quantity measure, and that's the type of financial condition seizing up that really I think rightly scares the Fed. Rightly so scares the Fed because if big companies, right, these are giant companies like the IBMs and Apples of the world, if they feel that they can't access bond markets because they're too disruptive, then that's really that's a really, really big negative shock to the economy as a whole. So in normal times, I agree with you. In times of severe stress in the financial sector, I don't think they're overly focused on the stock market. I think they're correctly highly focused on other parts of financial markets that are deeply problematic. I do agree with you that hiking 25 was silly. Either you're concerned about a banking crisis driven recession, or you're concerned about inflation. Splitting the difference means you're going to be wrong about one or the other, right? In my mind, and they just did it because they previously guided towards it, right? They were afraid of moving what we were talking. They were afraid of moving too quickly. They were afraid of not hitting the market. They were afraid of basically sort of just not following through on a previous promise. When in reality, if conditions change, you should change what your course of action is, and you should change your guidance. And I think that was silly. What I would have done if I were running the Fed at that moment is I would have said, look, there's an enormous amount of uncertainty right now. 2 weeks ago, we had a clear view of the world. Now we have a very, very cloudy view. A recession is highly possible, but so is the fact that this blows over like the Bank of like the UK pension crisis, and so we're just going to be on hold right now. But if it turns out that this blows over and 2 weeks from now banks are totally fine, then we're going to make up for skipping this by doing a 75 or 100 lot in May, right? We would like to do a 50 lot in March, but we're not gonna. We're going to hold because it could be that the banks are melting down. If the banks are melting down, we're going to turn around and cut in May. But if it turns out that this blows over in a month, the UK pension system blew up and a month later everyone moved on. If everyone moves on a month after this, then, we make up for it by doing a 75 or 100 lot the next meeting. And so, in reality, we won't really, we'll have skipped the meeting for we'll have skipped the hike for 3 weeks. But the interest rate curve will quickly price the fact that we're going to make up for it. That's what I would have done. I think optionality, given the huge amount of uncertainty ahead of us, the optionality is the critical thing. So
that, I'm going to pivot. That's what I should have been done too. I hadn't thought about that, but you're right. Pause and at the same time throw a sword of Damocles over the top of risk assets and tell them, you know what I mean? Because I think that what that would have done, the minute they said they were going to pause, equity markets would have rallied. But if they followed up like that, I think they probably would have just kept everything. I feel like that solution was the closest they possibly could have come to hitting pause. You know what I mean? I feel like it would have made things just kind of settle down and wait and see. That's probably, yeah. I think that makes, so I'm sold. I'm gonna pivot away from my call for higher rates and running QE at the same time because I think that would have been a much better policy decision.
And by the way, I wouldn't characterize myself as a dove in the current environment. I've been very, very critical of the Fed from the hawkish side from the very beginning, since from the very, very beginning. I think the earliest I was in writing in this was in the Wall Street Journal in the summer of 2021. So when Austin Goolsbee, the now president of the Chicago Fed, was on podcasts mocking people who were concerned about inflation, others of us were out there warning about it and being concerned about fiscal policy and what it was doing to the economy. And I've been very, very hawkish, critical of the Fed from the hawkish side. So for me to sort of say, look, I think that they should have paused at the last meeting, it's not the case that I'm some sort of, consistently dovish person who just, wants to save markets or, real estate or something like that. This was a change for me.
Yeah, well, and that's where we've gotten to, right? And that was another thing Marcos and I were talking about this morning was, in my opinion, I'm looking out at this and I'm going, you've pushed this down and you have tried to, morph risk and push risk out and volatility out for so long that we've gotten to a place where it looks to me, at least on the monetary side, that we don't have a painless path out. Right? That there looks to me like pain is unavoidable at this point. So that's kind of where I want to pivot the conversation. What we think should be done and what will be done, if history is any indicator, is probably a good space between those two. But what, with your knowledge of fiscal and monetary policy, what do we do now? Because clearly we've realized that the economy, I don't think it surprises you and doesn't surprise me. But clearly, I think the Fed has woken up to the idea that inflation is a much bigger danger than maybe that they were paying attention to, right? And a reacceleration of inflation. I mean, one of the things I think about is if you look at the problems caused by a 5% Fed funds rate, what do those problems look like at 6.5 or 6, right? The other side of it is, where do we go from here? Are there any easy paths out at this point? Because a giant monetary intervention is very stimulative, right? At the same time, you and I both know, and they've already proven that with their handling of the banking situation thus far, they're not going to sit back and watch the world burn. I kind of view if I look at what's happening in commercial real estate, I kind of feel like this duration thing is the first wave. And I don't see any way out of really significant write-downs on a lot of these banks' balance sheets with especially the A-class commercial real estate. I mean, I don't think people really appreciate this problem. We see it here. In Bellevue, the suburb of Seattle, you got 2 million square feet of vacant A-class office space. Okay? That's Bellevue. Now, what I'm telling you is if that's happening in Bellevue, the exodus is going to be even more intense in downtown Seattle because a lot of places are going to take advantage of that and move to Bellevue because there aren't people defecating on business storefronts in Bellevue, right? So, I'm looking at Bellevue going, okay, that's going to see – I just don't see any way around write-downs, right? Because everybody's like, well, if we lower rates – and I'm like, no. It's not just rates that it's killing office space. It's occupancy, right? It's lack of people. So I look at this. You kind of see this potential for wave after wave coming here. What do they do at this point? I got to admit to you, I'm confused. I know what I would do. I've got a good idea what I would do, but what are the options? Is there an easy way out?
There are no easy ways out. And that's because of the mistakes that were made in 2021. The origin of the mistake was that the COVID recession was different than the GFC, right? The financial crisis was a balance sheet recession. So afterwards, you had deleveraging. And so monetary policy couldn't really boost the economy. And the recovery was slow and crappy and disappointing and really painful for most Americans, right? COVID recession wasn't a balance sheet implosion. It was a virus. And people were sick and they were staying home. And then one day there was a vaccine and people could go out again. And so the thing that caused the recession was there, and then it went away. It wasn't – people weren't under years of bad balance sheets as a result, right? For the Fed to keep policy as it was in 21 and for the Biden administration to then go ahead and pump another $2 trillion into the economy with the American Recovery Plan and then another $900 in the Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act and then another $800 in the so-called Inflation Reduction Act, which is very inflationary because it front-loads all the spending and backloads all the it'll reduce the deficit in 2028. Cool. What does that do for us now? so it was the wrong medicine when the patient was getting up on his own of his own accord, and it was to pump him full of steroids just as he was recovering naturally. That was the policy mistake that led to the really metastasized the misallocations that may have in the economy, and now we're dealing with the aftermath of that. There is no easy way back. You're stuck with inflation. I think you have two choices. You either have to deal with persistently high inflation as a society, or you have to take the hard medicine and deal with recognizing the losses and the bad assets and the economic pain that comes along with that in order to create enough of an output gap that inflation and price pressures start coming down. The soft landing is theoretically possible in the same way that it's theoretically possible to land an airplane on a very, very, very thin, very thin runway, where the concrete is basically just the width of each wheel type of thing. But it's, in practice, the tools are not fine. They're blunt instruments, and it's effectively nearly impossible to achieve. And even if you achieve it, an example like 1994, wasn't a recession as we call recessions. So theoretically you could call a soft landing if you want, but it was still really painful for a lot of people, right? The NBER didn't call it a recession, but, the amount of time it took to find a job still, tripled. People were out of work. IP, industrial production contracted as though we were in a recession. This notion of is something a recession or not is like a binary label that is quite silly to me. A downturn is a downturn, whether you call it a recession or not. And the idea that we're going to solve this without pain strikes me as possible, but highly unlikely. So what can fiscal and monetary policy do? Well, the first thing fiscal policy could do is stop making it worse, right? You could immediately turn off the so-called Inflation Reduction Act, right? Do we need to be spending $300 billion of subsidies into, electric cars at this moment in the business cycle? Or should we perhaps wait to do that at a moment when there's actually a big output gap and you need to sort of recover from a recession? Because all you're doing is forcing the Fed to hike, to hike more, even in light of what's going on with the banks now. So the first thing fiscal policy could do is stop making it worse. As far as monetary policy, look, I think that the Fed has been doing the right thing, albeit too slowly. I think they never should have slowed down from the 75 clips that they did that they were doing, last year. And maybe to 50 clips, I think, would have been okay. But I think they certainly should never have slowed down to the 25s. And then they certainly should not have signaled that they were never going to reaccelerate from 25s, which, by the way, they had to walk back like a month later. In another reason why you should never do forward guidance the way this Fed does forward guidance. And by the way, can we just, on the forward guidance note, these guys are out there yapping all day, every day, when the market doesn't need to hear from them, saying too many enormously conflicting things, and then the banking system is melting down, and they're like, oh, blackout period. Sorry, we're going to talk your ear off in 10 different directions all day every day. Unless the banks are able to, oh, sorry, it's a blackout period. We have nothing to say. We have nothing to say. Just wait for Secretary Yellen to show up on the Sunday morning talk shows with nothing to show. The Fed is in a rough spot now because where we are now is with enormous amount of uncertainty. I think a few weeks ago, the economy was very resilient to interest rates, it was very clearly, people say the Fed is going to hike until it breaks something, right? And that's how it may have hiked enough. We may be at that point now, right? And I think sort of knowing that there was going to be damage, knowing that there was going to be some sort of bank run, some sort of major failure, whether it turned into a bank run or some other significant institution failing, should not be surprising, right? Knowing it was going to be Silicon Valley Bank on March 10th would have been, I think, almost impossible to predict for anyone. So this could have happened on March 10th, or it could have happened in January, or it could have happened or it could have occurred in August of this year. Whether it occurred 6 months earlier or 6 months later, I think it would have been impossible to time, but it was bound to occur eventually, and now it's occurred. And so now I think the correct thing to do is to sort of step back, try and get a handle on just how big the deleveraging is going to be that we see, and whether that really sort of is enough of a growth in inflation effect to get inflation under control.
One of the things I've been thinking about, and I've been trying to tell people this, you know, anytime you get stuff like going on like this, you're going to get the bear porn, right? End of the world is coming. It's either hyperinflation or a Great Depression. And one of the things I've been saying is, guys, this isn't 08-09. Okay, it's not similar in a lot of ways. And one of the things that seems to me to be more similar to me would be the savings and loan crisis. What do you think the chances are? And I'm just thinking of the Fed here and their track record. What do you think the chances of them are speaking with this? Because, I do think that this office space problem is a bigger problem than people think. Meaning, I think it has the potential to really add stress to the banking sector and blow a hole in some balance sheets. So I would like to hear your thoughts on that. But if I'm thinking about that problem, what do you think the odds of the Fed launching something like the Resolution Trust Corporation to buy up some of these assets, get them off bank balance sheets? Do I think that's what they should do? No. You're going to have to take the pain at some point. I just don't believe that they're going to do that. I think that they're going to roll this game until they can't. Now, it seems to me that inflation is taking the keys out of their hands. I just don't know if I really believe that they're going to acknowledge that. So what do you think about that? And do you think that inflation has taken the keys out of their hand? Or do you think that responding with something like the Resolution Trust Corporation, this iteration's version of it or whatever, do you think that's something that – do you think they're going to go down that path? Or do you think they're going to let they're going to let the pain hit?
So I completely agree that – I think you're completely right that this looks more like the SNL crisis than it does like 2008, because what we see is a large number of banks, but a large number of smaller banks potentially in trouble, but none of those banks are subject to the types of interbank obligations that could bring down the entire system, right? So I think that you can wind up having them, you know, having them fail, and you know, we could have a recession, but it's not going to look like a crisis like 2008. Absolutely, we can have a recession. I don't think that it's going to look like as bad as 2008. What the Fed will do, first of all, let me say something, which is the Fed, especially this Fed, is capable of enormous cognitive dissonance, right? You were talking a moment ago about how the Bank of England was hiking and doing QE at the same time, but insisting that it wasn't QE. And in 2019, when the Fed was, you know, sort of decided that it had drained too many reserves from the system and then started to, you know, redo some asset purchases to put some reserves back into the system, insisted, bent over backwards, it's not QE. It's not QE. It's just plumbing, you know. And so I mockingly refer to balance sheet expansions that the Fed insists are not QE as not QE. So it's not that the Fed is not doing QE. It's that the Fed is doing not QE.
Right.
And so I think that it's very, very possible that they wind up, you know, doing not QE and hiking at the same time, you know, for the sake of financial stability purposes. And frankly, you know, I'm not sure that would really be the wrong move. The Fed is going to say, you know, financial stability is one lane, inflation targeting is another lane. We see no reason why we can't pursue both objectives at the same time. And if we have to add reserves to the system for the sake of financial stability, while at the same time we keep hiking, we'll do that. I'm not saying that's what's going to happen, you know, whether that's going to happen through a trust resolution company, like you said before, or through doing not QE. You know, I don't know, right? But it's very, very plausible to me that they do something that involves balance sheet expansion, some form of not QE, right? While at the same time, sort of saying, okay, we have to keep hiking. And if it turns out that, you know, financial stability jitters are real, but not enough to bring down inflation, that arguably is the right, you know, is the right move, because I don't think that you should allow the banking system to have tons and tons and tons of failures. I think you should, you know, you should be used to the fact that banks will fail and say it's okay for a number of small banks to fail without, you know, sort of endangering the system. But if you had a systemic problem, yeah, I mean, I wouldn't disagree with intervening to save the system, obviously.
Well, and I'm pretty hawkish. You know, I've been on the radio now for 7 years raging against the Fed and raging against monetary policy and saying that we should be off the zero bound. I'm right with you in 21. I was sitting there going – it was kind of one of those deals where you're looking around going, hey, guys, you might want to start hiking. You know what I mean? And it was just just oblivious to it.
And absolutely.
Hearing Goolsbee talk, and I'm sitting there going, guys, how can you have supply chains kink like this and pour this much kerosene on the fire and not expect it to go out of control? I just didn't – I didn't understand it. And there was a part of me that sat there and thought, you know – Maybe I'm just way off here, you know. Like I didn't understand the thought process, but when you're looking at this situation now, and the reason why I said I brought up the Resolution Trust companies or the corporation was because if I'm looking at these, if I'm looking especially on that commercial office space side, looking at those loans, I don't see really any other fix that isn't going to further pressure balance sheets. But I want to get to the more pressing conversation. When I look at all of these scenarios, and I agree with you, I feel like, you know, and I don't know if it's new, but I feel like the word recession, first of all, has morphed into depression, right? Like the U.S. economy on average historically had a recession every 6.5 years, correct?
Yeah. And we've had the last two were rough, right? We had the pandemic recession, which was actually not that rough economically because of what we did on policy, but it was psychologically very rough because of the public health, the public health aspects of it. And then before that, we had 2008. And so, you know, recessions are always bad. People losing their jobs, have permanent effects on their careers and their families and their health. And it's bad, and you know it's unfortunate that it has to happen. But really, it's a fact of life. The business cycle exists, and wishing it away isn't going to make it disappear.
Right. So, when we get into recession versus not recession, and I know that you have a little bit different view, and that's why I was excited to discuss it with you. I look at the backdrop today, whether we're talking yield curve inversion, whether we're talking about commercial real estate, residential, the banking issues, inflation, all that kind of stuff. Look, I've been doing this long enough to sit there. The old adage, more money has been lost in the anticipation of recession than has actually been lost in recession. Right. Mm. And I think that's hard to argue with. But I don't see any way out, man. I'm looking at it and going, I don't see how you get out of this without unemployment moving higher. Again, I don't think we're going to hit 10 or, what'd we top out in the GFC? Was it 12, 13, something like that?
Yeah, I think it was about, it was just over 10, I think.
Yeah. So I don't see that going on. I don't see any way out of this without recession. I think that you have said that you think that it's certainly the odds on, right? It's the lead horse right now. Where do you differ from me though? Because where I'm looking at this, and I'll be honest with you, 100% certainty really scares me in this business. So I'll say 95% for me. You don't seem that you're not, you don't think it's that certain. Walk
so
us
let me,
that.
Let me back up and say that, I think a lot of disagreements in investing come down to different time horizons, right? And I'm thinking in a 3 to 6 month time horizon. And so do I believe that we will be able to get inflation down without a meaningful amount of economic pain? The answer is no, right? I think that inflation, if we don't have a recession now, inflation will remain a problem. And that just means the Fed then has to hike to 6.5%, and then we'll have a recession then. And if magically 6.5% doesn't induce a recession, then the Fed will have to hike to 7.5%, and then we'll have a recession then, right? You know, I don't know in a world in which SVB hadn't blown up, I don't know where the terminal rate would have been, but it would have been higher. So my view is not that we will be able to avoid a recession. My view is that I don't know if this is the catalyst that puts us into a recession in the near term.
Okay.
Right.
So I look at and I'm going to throw this out there because I don't again, I just want to hear your take on it. I think back to Milton Friedman's famous quote. What is something like inflation is everywhere and always a monetary phenomenon. Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
I probably butchered that in some way. But So I didn't butcher it. OK, so I kind of look at it, inflation. First of all, I think inflation is a much more complicated discussion than most people make it out to be, right? And I've used this on my show as an example. If I told you that in 2022 we were going to have the highest rate of inflation that we've seen in 40 years, would you believe me if I would have told you during that same year the dollar would have hit a 23-year high and gold went nowhere? you know, would you believe me? You know, everybody go, no, 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 right?
And I absolutely, yeah.
Yeah, and I use that as an example to explain to our listeners, guys, this isn't as easy as you think it is, especially if you listen to the guys on the TV and the infomercials trying to sell you gold, right? right? The hyperinflation is coming, baby. What do we do? I look at this in two ways. I kind of view it as behavioral and structural. In my view, I think that the Fed is hiked high enough to deal with the structural side of it. And I think you can see that in evidence of the bank pain and the duration issues and commercial real estate issues, all the stuff that we've talked about. But to me, it looks like they haven't broken the fever on the behavioral side. What is your take on that? Do you agree with that? Am I oversimplifying? Rip it apart, endorse it. Just kind of give me your critique on that thought.
So, I mean, to be fair to Friedman, he did change his mind later in his life and say that he recognized that there were, you know, inflation things like supply shocks, oil shocks and whatnot that weren't monetary that actually could move the needle on inflation a lot. But as far as whether the Fed has hiked high enough to control all that stuff, I think on the one hand, it's sort of a moot point now because the world has changed in the last 2 weeks, absolutely. And sort of to talk about the pre-SVB economy, the pre-Silicon Valley Bank failure economy, is sort of pointless because that economy doesn't exist anymore, right? We now live in an economy with rolling bank crises, right? I don't know if crisis is the right word, but you know maybe it is. I don't know. And that world is fundamentally different in many ways than the pre-SVB economy. If I look at the pre-SVB economy, you know, I think we were sort of moving into a world in which Elizabeth Warren, through no accomplishment of her own, had sort of accidentally become correct in a sense. She complained a lot about corporate margins and consolidation and pricing power, and I think that last year that was not at all a driver of inflation. I think it had become a driver of inflation in the last couple of quarters. I think, you know, you saw a lot of companies say stuff like, you know, hey, you know, our volumes are down 1-3%, but actually we're thrilled because we're able to raise prices by 8%, right? And so they're very happy to be able to raise prices by 8% and have volumes down down only a few percent because that's more profit for them. And so you did have episodes of inflation being driven by the change in consumer psychology that allowed companies to get away with raising prices while volumes were going down. And a lot of that is because, well, wages are still growing strongly, which lends to that consumer psychology that allows those companies to get those profit margins. And the other thing, and this is, I think, where Elizabeth Warren didn't have a point last year and sort of had a point now, at least until March 10th. I don't know if it's still going to be valid. Competition is a problem, right? You know, I think that the U.S. economy suffers from a lot of competition problems where there's monopolies monopolies and oligopolies that collude with each other to set high prices and a lack of competition. I also happen to think that competition is due to regulations and barriers to entry. It is incredibly hard to start a business in this country. It is incredibly hard to enter a market. We regulate everything from haircuts to hedge funds. And those barriers to entry make it difficult to compete and benefit the incumbents and encourage consolidation and encourage companies devouring each other and just growing into giant conglomerates. I agree that this is a problem now, but I think, frankly, you know, sort of things that we could, you know, after two years of hearing, you know, sort of folks from that political persuasion yell about inflation being due purely to the supply side, I would like some policies from them that work to improve the supply side and make it more responsive to consumer demand by reducing regulations that made it difficult to compete. Our small company of like three people has a tax return of like 170 pages, right? And we've got four advanced degrees between the three of us. And you're going to tell me that like, you know, it's easy to start a business in this country and compete. No, it's not at all. So I'm not sure I'm actually answering the question you answered, but
No, you
but
are.
I've answered some question. I'm not sure it's the one you answered.
In your schooling and your study, do you pay any homage to the behavioral aspects of inflation that, you know, that euphoric consumers, you know, that aspect of it? What do you make of that? Because in my opinion, you know, looking at the stock market, which I run a high probability of maybe being a little bit too myopic looking at it through this lens, but when I look at the stock market action, it feels to me like the equity market's being driven by the last 15 years, meaning it feels like investors just aren't getting the memo. I think we could probably sit here and debate for hours how much of a feed through equity markets have to inflation. I've seen really good, I believe it's a component. I don't believe it's the biggest driver. Do you think the behavioral side? Because I think the one thing we saw in 2021, the animal spirits were certainly loosed, right? I mean, it feels to me like they're still running. I mean, not as hot as they were in 2021. Do you give any credence to that, or do you just sit there and go, no, let's address the structural side. That aspect of it will take care of itself.
Oh, I absolutely think the behavioral element is very important. And so, you know, you talk about things like inflation expectations, right? I think that counts as a behavior element. Consumers become accustomed, you know, households become accustomed to certain things happening, like prices going up. And the longer you allow, and part of the reason why I've been so critical of this Fed is that, and they've made this point themselves, the longer you allow inflation to run at a very high rate, the more you are cementing for households behaviorally, for consumers behaviorally, that these price increases are normal. And that this is just going to keep happening. And the more you accustom people to thinking that this is normal and this is just going to keep happening, the harder it is to get it down, right? And the more pain you have to deliver to the economy to get it down, which is why the tolerance for inflation at the start was such the mistake, right? You nip it in the bud, because not nipping into the bud makes it much harder to control later on. And as far as markets go, I mean, yeah, I absolutely agree with that. And economics goes, and that's why, there's a big debate over financial conditions indices, right? And there are people that you know, sort of embrace them, and people that hate them. I find them pretty useful. I don't take them as, you know, Moses didn't come down from Sinai with a financial conditions index from Bloomberg, Goldman Sachs, or the Chicago Fed, right? But nevertheless, they're informative. You know, and like I said before, you know, there's things they don't pick up, like the total sudden stop in IG issuance last week. That doesn't get captured in financial conditions index, but it's sure as heck a financial condition that got really, really bad very quickly with a significant growth implication, which is part of why the Fed, I think, was, you know, ultimately so dovish this week. And, you know, financial conditions influence behavior, right? There's a behavioral, there's a reflexive element whereby if the Fed, and this is why I was so critical of the Fed in Q4 of last year, right, until the Fed became hawkish again in February and early March. If you allow financial conditions to loosen, you have a much harder time slowing the economy. You have a much harder time controlling inflation. If stocks are not going down, then firms are really going to, you know, sort of not really lay off enough people to get the unemployment rate to a place where inflation is, you know, sort of going to be able to come under control. If the dollar keeps on moving down, right, then firms have both a real fundamental reason and an excuse to keep raising prices, because the cost of everything that we import becomes more and more expensive. Right. And so financial conditions do behaviorally transmit into real economic outcomes. And so I find them very useful myself. There is a criticism, right, which is that you're using financial markets to forecast the economy, to forecast financial markets. So you're basically using financial markets to forecast financial markets. I'm very aware of that criticism, and sort of therefore know that you have to, you can't just take these things at face value. You have to really think about, you know, what does it mean when you're looking at it. But yeah, I think that they're important.
Yeah. Okay. So you've been kind enough to give us a little over an hour of your time here. And one of the things I like to do at the end of these is ask you what it is that you're watching, running your macro hedge fund. What are the things that you guys are focused on right now that we haven't discussed? What is the elephant in the room? Where do you see opportunities? I'll just tell you right now, for a guy that hasn't liked bonds for a really long time, I'm loving me some duration right now. especially with treasuries. Well, what are you looking at, and where do you think the opportunities and the potential landmines are going forward?
Yeah, sure. So I also, like, you know, in the like I said, I don't know whether we are going to have a recession in the next 3 to 6 months. I think that there's very, very little visibility in the economic front because it winds up being a function of how bad the banking pressures get. And that's, I think, a behavioral element of, are you going to have deposit flight from these things? And, you know, predicting whether households are going to pull their deposits, I think, is very tough. So the economic outlook is very unclear to me. But on Wednesday, I think the Fed basically told the market that the risk on yields was very asymmetric. They told the market that they were content to let the banking pressures do the tightening for them, that therefore they didn't really see the need to do any more tightening, right? They told the market that, look, you know, we think yields are sort of done now. That makes the bond market very, you know, the bond market very asymmetric, right? And so the market will then, when you tell the market that there's an asymmetric risk, the market will then press it, because humans love to take risk. You can't get rid of volatility, and people will lever up and take risk when they see a one-sided bet. And so for that reason, I think that there's a trade in being, you know, long bonds, you know, received rates. However you want to put it, until the market seems to have priced, you know, the 50-50 odds of a recession. You know, if I think it's a toss-up on a recession or not, you know, right now, like, I don't think we're at 50-50 yet on the bond market in terms of pricing a recession. We're not that far, but, you know, relative to what we've come already. But, you know, I don't think we're there yet. And so I think there's a trade there, even though there's very little visibility on the economic outcomes. As far as what I think is important to watch right now, I think that the data, you know, the data are all backward looking now, too backward looking, right? You know, all the data from before SVB, right, I think are not very informative, right? Data moving forward that reflect that are going to be interesting. So as we get the next couple of claims prints, right, especially the continuous claim print next week, I think is going to be very interesting, especially because that's reflective of the survey week for the payrolls month, the continuing claims print that prints next Thursday. You know, and so that I think is going to be very interesting. But I think it's also going to be very interesting to watch the Federal Reserve's H-8 report, which should be hitting, you know, which should be hitting relatively soon. That'll give you an idea of deposit outflows from the smaller banks. And if it looks like deposits are actually really aggressively fleeing the smaller banks, that has the possibility to compound this stuff. And if they're not, if the deposit seems relatively stable, then, well, you know, like, maybe the pressures aren't going to be that bad. Or maybe it just makes them sort of slow and long-term and chronic rather than acute. And then, of course, that has an implication as well.
One last question. I said that was going to be last. What do you make of the tightening credit situation? We're looking at commercial real estate banks. We've already seen a massive adjustment in terms of loan-to-value, what they'll do just in the last month. What kind of impact – I mean – obviously, it's not a good impact for risk assets. Are you saying that you think that tightening of the banks on those that maybe that's transitory, depending on how things play out, and maybe things get back to normal? Or does that credit tightening concern you, and do you think that's kind of a blinking yellow light or red light or whatever?
Yeah, look, I'm not. That's part of my – I wouldn't say that's my exclusive concern, but I would say, yeah, that's definitely part of the concern on the banking system in general. The issue is that for a lot of these smaller banks, the assets are not worth what they were, and now they're experiencing deposit flights, and they have to fund themselves at rates that are higher than what they're earning on the asset side, and that makes them unprofitable, and that drives down the stock price, which of course makes people concerned that it'll fail, which encourages more deposit flight, and it becomes a vicious reinforcing circle, right? So the question is, how far does that go? And there is pressure on these small banks, both not only to stop extending credit in the future, but potentially to sell their old assets as well. And small banks generated, over the last 12 months, they generated about $570 billion of credit, right? That's like 2% of GDP, 2 percentage points of GDP. So, you know, if that goes to zero, right, obviously that's enough to move the needle on the economy, right? Now, you know, just being, you know, somewhat conservative, let's say that, you know, a dollar of bank credit only increases GDP by half a dollar because some of it goes into asset prices, you know, some of it goes into home prices or CRE prices or whatever, as opposed to actual activity. So if that, you know, if that credit goes to zero, maybe you shave a point of GDP, right? Okay, well, things weren't super, you know, things were, you know, sort of, you know, they weren't super super invulnerable to begin with, right? And then the question is, what do the big banks do too? Do the big banks offset some of that lending because actually they have deposits coming in? So they increase their lending? Or do the big banks wind up lending less also because, A, there's general tensions in the banking sector now, and so they're just put on the defensive? Or, B, small banks are actually not only reducing their lending to zero, they're actually shedding assets. They're selling their old assets, too. And so all of the incremental new lending done by big banks winds up just buying the assets that the smaller banks are shedding, right? And so if the big banks wind up lending less into the economy also, then okay, yeah, you've got enough, I think, to get a recession underway. But it's a chain of ifs, and we have to watch and see what happens to credit creation. Because I think a lot of it winds up on anticipating how much pressure are these smaller banks going to be under to stop their new lending, to shed their old assets, and then how much pressure are the big banks going to be under either to compensate for the shortfall in lending by increasing their own lending or to accelerate the downside by further decreasing their own lending in addition. That's sort of the chain of stuff that I see and that I personally find difficult to predict precisely how it's going to work out right now.
Yeah, I mean, I think everybody does. If they tell you they got it, it's like I always say, everybody's opinion matters except the guy that tells you he's certain, right?
Yeah, look, 2 weeks ago, I had a very strong view of the U.S. economy. I had a very strong view of which way it was going. I knew something was going to break eventually. I didn't obviously have any idea that it was going to be Silicon Valley Bank on March 10th, but stuff's changed since then. And now I just see so much more uncertainty than I think there's been at any time since I was at Treasury in April of 2020 in the depths of the COVID recession. I think there hasn't been this much uncertainty since then.
All right, pal. Well, hey, we're going to have to do this again, especially as things unfold. I can't say thank you enough for coming on. We really appreciate it. And for all the folks out there, I think that Steve's obviously proved why we wanted to have him on here. But you can follow him on Twitter at Steve Miran, STEVEMIRAN. And then also, if you're interested in the macro hedge fund, they can go to amberwavepartners.com. Is that correct?
Yep, that's correct.
All right, amberwavepartners.com. Obviously, really sharp guy. I would encourage you to check that out. Anything else that we need to tell the folks how to contact you or look at your work or anything like that?
Yeah, I mean, feel free to look me up on Twitter. Feel free to get in touch on the website. You can send us a message. You can contact me on Twitter. It's all good. Love to hear from people.
All right, pal. Well, thanks again. And like I said, we'll have to do this again as these things unfold and we get a little more clarity.
Thanks for having me. Really enjoyed it.
You bet. All right, you guys, we got to cut it off there. I hope you enjoyed it as much as I did. We got a couple of we should have two interviews on deck for next week. Still trying to get Andreas Steno-Larsen squared away. He's been swamped. But anyway, we'll be back next week. Have a phenomenal weekend. Manage your risk as always. That's important these days. We'll see you next week. You're listening to the Know Your Risk Radio podcast. Download and subscribe at knowyourriskradio.com.
The opinions expressed in this program are for general informational purposes only and are not intended to provide specific advice or recommendations for any individual or on any specific security. It is only intended to provide education about the financial industry. To determine which investments may be appropriate for you, consult your financial advisor prior to investing. Any past performance discussed during this program is no guarantee of future results. Any indices referenced for comparison are unmanaged and cannot be invested into directly. As always, please remember investing involves risk and possible loss of principal capital. Please seek advice from a licensed professional. Investment advice cannot be given without a client service agreement. Bulwark Capital Management is an investment advisor representative of Trek Financial, LLC, an SEC registered investment advisor.